Nestor Almendros once made the observation that everything seems more interesting on film than in real life. Those of us who agree should thank cinematographers like Nestor Almendros for making those moving pictures so captivating. Almendros was called one of the greatest directors of photography by the late film director François Truffaut. They made 9 movies together, including The Wild Child and The Last Metro. In the United States, Almendros was the cinematographer for Kramer vs. Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and Places in the Heart. He won an Academy Award for his work on Days of Heaven. Nestor Almendros grew up in Spain. After the fascists won the Civil War, his father went into exile in Cuba and sent for the rest of the family in 1948. Almendros despised the Cuban film industry under Batista and left for France as a young adult, but he returned after the revolution and wrote film criticism and directed about 20 Cuban documentaries. Then he left Cuba again to work in France. He now lives in France, Barcelona, and New York. Almendros has directed a new documentary. It's called Nobody Listened. It's about human rights violations in Cuba under Castro. It features testimony from former political prisoners now living in exile. It's a follow-up to his 1984 documentary on a similar subject called Improper Conduct. Nestor Almendros, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're really known around the world as a cinematographer, yet you've decided to direct this new documentary, and I'd like to know why you wanted to make this documentary.
Well, first of all, I've directed before. I was a cinematographer. I did many documentaries in Cuba and in France. And this documentary, I made it because I think that what's happening in Cuba, oddly enough, is not well known. I mean, what's happening in Chile, for instance, in South Africa, which is as horrible as it is, at least they have the benefit of having the sympathy of most of the people. But the Cuban subject is ignored, and it's scandalous.
I think you're making the comparison to Stalin in your movie, that the left in America didn't want to recognize the atrocities under Stalin, and I think you're saying that the left in America doesn't want to open its eyes to what's happening in Cuba.
That is true, yes. The left in America is very slow in understanding, although there are people who have changed, like Susan Sontag and other people who remain on the left and have changed. I wouldn't say that all the left is favorable to Castro. They're usually, those who are favorable, they are people who are very misinformed, people who are misinformed who prefer to dream.
Now, you started your film career in Cuba. You made a lot of state-sponsored documentaries about Cuba when you were there. And then you became disillusioned. What was responsible for that disillusionment?
Well, many little things, of course, and big things at the same time. I mean, you could see that the press was being controlled. Even our filmmaking was totally controlled by the government. We had to make constantly propaganda for the government, you know. But also the fire squads, the killings. I remember one night I was having dinner on the port of Havana with a group of friends, and I heard at the distance, bang, bang, bang. And I said, what is it? To someone, I said, don't you know? They're killing people in the Cabana Fortress, which is across the bay. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't eat anymore.
So that's part of the reason why you left the country.
Yes. I also knew that if I would stay there, I would end in prison.
You say in your autobiography, which is called, well, it's part autobiography, part about the movies you've made, it's called A Man with a Camera, and you say that in one of Castro's speeches, he condemned one of your movies.
Oh, no. He condemned someone else's movie, a movie I had defended, a documentary called PM, which was totally innocuous politically, but it was not produced by the government. And these people were just dismissed, and I was also dismissed as a film critic for having defended the movie.
In your new documentary, the shooting style is very straightforward. You have done some really gorgeous cinematography for narrative movies, and this is very, very straightforwardly done.
Yes, on purpose, yes. Uh-huh. I think there's no room
headshots or talking heads, we'd call it.
Yeah, there's no room for aesthetics in a documentary. I think a good documentary should document and should left aside. I mean, it has to be beautiful, of course, and things have to be seen well, correctly. But there's no room for fireworks in photography or in music. You notice, for instance, that the film has
no music.
No music in the background, underlining anything.
Sure, because you'd know every trick in the books for making the lighting really dramatic. So if someone's telling a dramatic story about their imprisonment, it would look as dramatic as it sounded, but you don't do any of that.
No, I tried to be as normal and as close to the life as possible and see the face as well. I believe that the face, especially the eyes, are like a lie detector. And the more you see it, the better. I mean, the audience has to see that these people are not lying. They're saying an awful truth. And the more you see them, if you start doing arty lighting with half-lit faces, that might be very beautiful, but you don't see the eyes.
My guest is cinematographer Nestor Almendros. Now, as you pointed out, this is not the first film that you've directed, and in fact, you started your career as a film director in Cuba. Why did you switch over to cinematography? Because let's face it, it's directors that have the most glory as far as the behind-the-scenes people in movies.
Well, because when I arrived in France, exiled from Cuba, with no money, no help, I had to make a living. And I was a director, which was also a photographer. I mean, I was doing cinema verite, handheld camera. So I thought that if I could get people to use me on the professional, on the technical side, that would be easier to break into the business. And so it happened, especially when you are for free, you always find people that want you. And that's how I started the career. And then a career I really didn't think it was going to be my career, because I didn't intend to be a cinematographer. It just went skyrocketing, and then it even brought me to Hollywood.
You know, when I see a movie that I think is beautifully shot, I never really know who I should credit with it, whether it's the director or the cinematographer.
The director, always. The director. I mean, you cannot make good cinematography if you don't have a director behind letting you do it. So ultimately, it belongs to him. And the first question you said before that I forgot to tell you, the second part of it, is that doing cinematography for a man like Truffaut, or for Robert Benton, or Alan Pakula, or now Scorsese, as I'm going to, it's no sacrifice. It's really wonderful to work with a great genius, you know, and there's no regrets about it. It would be terrible if I would make bad movies, but I have made very few bad movies.
So that's really true. Now, you were telling me before that when you decide whether or not you're going to do a film, the first thing you want to know is who's the director.
Exactly. I am a film buff, and I practice la politique des auteurs of Cahiers du Cinéma. I believe that the worst film of Buñuel is better than the best film of a mediocre director.
Let's look at a couple of scenes from movies that you've directed and talk about what you did to get that look. Let's start with Days of Heaven. That's the movie that you won your Academy Award for. It's set in the American Midwest during the Depression. And there's a scene in which all the field workers are trying to pick, the locusts have invaded, and they're trying to pick the locusts off the wheat fields. And they're picking them off and then burning them. But for reasons I won't go into, the wheat field catches on fire, and there's a huge fire that engulfs this enormous wheat field. And you have all the characters silhouetted in basically black outline against these wheat fields. It's absolutely stunning. It's very hard, I'm sure, to film
no,
a fiery scene like that.
No, it isn't, in fact. Well, first of all, to begin with, we had to have a scene that gave opportunities to the cinematographer to shine. And here was a big fire. It wasn't the script. Terrence Malick had thought about it. He's a sort of a pyroman, do you say, or an arson man.
Pyromaniac?
He loves fire, you know. And also, he's a man from the country. He was from Oklahoma and Texas. He knows the fields. He worked in the harvester. So he knows that very well. Now, how you solve that? That's where I come. I believe that very often when you have a fire seen on the movie, they always have arc lights lighting on the dark side, and then by doing that they destroyed the effect of the fire. I thought that it would be better not to do any lighting and just leave them in silhouette, as you noticed, and it makes like cave painting in a way, and there's a great beauty. Of course, we asked the people to be in profile, because that's how you know a little bit who is who.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, Richard Gere and Brooke Adams, they are in profile and silhouette, so you know who they are. There's a little trick, but we did two takes, one with light, for instance, in that scene, and one without.
With artificial light.
Yes, just to fill up, you know, so you would read on the faces. I thought that the one in silhouette would be better, and I was glad that Malick chose the one in silhouette.
Now, in the scene, there are sparks flying. It's very smoky. How do you keep a camera lens clean to observe
clean.
All of this?
It isn't clean. The cameras have to be cleaned afterwards. They get dirty. And then we smell of a smoke. The fire scene was shot during 10 days. It was, and the film is only 10 minutes perhaps, but it was 10 days. We burned a different field every day, and we were all smoking. We had goggles to protect ourselves from the smoke. And the cameras, it's a miracle that nothing happened, but they could have been damaged, you know. There's always a little bit of risk in that kind of thing.
You said you burned a different wheat field every day. How did you find fields to burn?
Well, that belonged to a religious group called the Hutterites, but they're related to the Memnonites. They have enormous amounts of wheat. They have enormous amounts of field because it's collective ownership. And they just sold it for the price of the harvest. They were very happy. They didn't have to harvest and they got the money from it.
How do you know for sure that a take is going to be good? For instance, in this scene in Days of Heaven where there's fire raging out of control, you'd better know that that take is a good take. You're not going to want to, after the fires are all put out, you're not going to want to do this again.
Well, that's that's the great excitement of films, that you don't know precisely. So when you see the rushes later on a dark room, you're always surprised. It's usually, as we said at the beginning, better than in life. Things always look better in movies. And sometimes you're disappointed, but most of the times it's better.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. Now let's compare what you did on Days of Heaven with another movie that you shot. You shot Kramer versus Kramer. Now, Days of Heaven has obvious opportunities for incredible photography because you're talking about landscape shots, you're talking about period photography, it's made in the Depression. Kramer versus Kramer is a naturalistic movie set in apartment buildings and office buildings, and it's a very, you know,
it's
realistic type of movie.
It's the most difficult thing to do.
Now, I think it would be the other way around.
No,
that a period movie
the other one's
be more
piece
difficult.
Of cake, you know, making a film with landscapes and waterfalls or they're the films that win Oscars always and frankly non-deserved very often. The moment you have a film with thousands of extras, costumes, especially if it's a costume movie in India or in South America or in a period movie like ours, which people were not dressed like today, and you have mountains and fields and clouds, but that's there by Mother Nature. Yet people think, oh, what wonderful photography, and it's the easiest thing of the world. But doing an apartment like in Kramer, every day, you know, every day, banality, get beauty out of it. That's the toughest thing.
Yeah, so what are the challenges shooting Kramer versus Kramer in an apartment building and an office building?
Well, that it has, although it's shot in a studio, the apartment of Kramer was built in a studio. It's not a real one. It was copied after a real one.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some window scenes that were shot in the real one, but most of the shoot was done there. So to make people feel that they are there, that it's true, that's not a set, that's not fake, you know, that feeling of reality, also of a three-dimensional feeling, especially for night scenes, which are the most difficult to do, that there is a depth, that there's a lamp here and a dark area, and then another, like it happens in life, there's a dark area here and a lighter one there. And then also that the different rooms of an apartment, people are aware of it, that people feel that they could walk into that apartment, that that's not abstract, that it's true, that could be theirs. And that takes some kind of, you know, engineering. You have to.
Let's look at the actors that you had to shoot in Kramer versus Kramer.
Well, that also, it's the most important film. This kind of movie has an advantage over the other kind, which we said, is that the actors come out wonderfully because they have no competition.
Well, one of the leading actresses in it is Meryl Streep, who you also shot in Sophie's Choice.
She was practically discovered in Kramer. I mean, that's what it made out of her a star.
Compare how you lit her for Sophie's Choice with how you lit her in Kramer versus Kramer and why. The different ways you shot
her
in both those films.
Yeah, it's very different. Sophie's Choice is a very stylized movie. Here it's a period movie too. It doesn't happen today. It happens after the war.
Right.
So here you have the chance to stylize things because people have forgot how things were. That's the advantage of doing films which are period. Also, you have all those flashbacks in Poland, which allowed us to do also some stylish photography. But in Sophie's, we sort of got ourselves inspired from Technicolor movies of the 50s, you know. The lighting was a little more harsh, bigger shadows, more expressionistic, whereas in Kramer it was more naturalistic.
Mm. When you're arranging the light so that you'll have exactly the kind of effect you want to achieve, then the character's going to move. I mean, is that a problem, that if you want a certain dramatic lighting effect, that they might move the wrong way or move right out of
that
effect?
Well, that's a compromise. In fact, the good way should be let the actors do their number first and then do the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do the lighting and then you ask them to move into the lights.
So you watch them rehearse
first
and then figure out how to light it.
First they rehearse, the director decides where they should do, where they should go. And then I'll come and I'll do some lighting. And sometimes we will tell them, why instead of walking there, don't you walk to the other side so you'll get a better light? And some actors like Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, they have a good sense of light. They really know where the light is. Sometimes you don't even have to tell them. They have tropism, you know. They know where the light is.
Now look at someone like Dustin Hoffman. He's got a very big nose, a kind of unusual face. Does he require a certain kind of lighting?
Well, he is like a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You say that?
Chameleon, yeah.
Chameleon, yeah. He can be anything. In Kramer, he's very handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And so is in the first film he made, The Graduate.
Right.
And if he wants to be ugly, then he can be Rizzo in that film.
Midnight Cowboy.
Midnight Cowboy. He can be anything he wants, like Meryl Streep, too. Meryl looks very ugly in Ironweed, and she wanted to be. You know, and I thought that we made him look quite good in Kramer. He looks like, I mean, he's not Gary Cooper, but he's an acceptable man, I think.
What do you look at in a face when deciding how you're going to light it?
Well, I belong to the Greek or Roman tradition, so I do have an idea of beauty, which, of course, has to do with that inherited culture that we have. I mean, if a person has a huge nose, then we'll try to not to show that, because the Greeks had that sense of proportion. The mouth could not be that big, the eye, the nose, and the eye should be of a good size, and the ears also. So I look at that first without any consideration for the light. I try to see the person as you see an animal, not really forgetting that you are a man, you know. And then once you see these defects that the person might have, you try to conceal them with the lighting or with the framing or with the position of the person in front of the camera. You know, if a person has an ugly profile, you'll try not to have this person in profile very often. And if it has a beautiful profile, then it's the opposite, you know.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendros is my guest. And by the way, his latest movie is actually a documentary that he directed, and it's about human rights violations in Cuba.
By the way, I co-directed it.
Co-directed. Okay,
co-directed
thank you for pointing
that
out.
Co-directed with Jorge Yula.
A Cuban emigre.
A Cuban emigre. Really born in Cuba, not like me.
Let's talk about black and white versus color. You have shot some movies in black and white, including My Night at Maud's.
Yes.
Of course, you started, unlike film history, which started in black and white and went to color, you started in color and did a few films in black and white.
Yeah.
Now, Wim Wenders, when I recently interviewed him, said that black and white is the most difficult thing
to shoot
and to develop. Do you agree with him?
Yes, it is very difficult because, it is difficult and it is easy. It has some easy aspects and some difficult. The easy one, I'll start by that, is that it's very elegant.
Yes.
You cannot be of bad taste in black and white. Everything looks correct. You see the worst movie of the 40s, which was in black and white, and there's always a basic elegance. I mean, things, they never have that gaudy aspect that bad movies have today, you know. Then the other problem that black and white has is that because of the lack of information of black and white, the lighting has to be like a painting. You have to be silhouetting things, singling out objects and things you want to see, because you see much less in black and white.
Because it's all shades of gray.
Because
there's no colors to stand out.
There's very little to tell. People have to see what's happening with only black and white. Whereas the other one, there's an infinite amount of colors which tell you different things. So you have to color a black and white has to be much more refined, you know, and much more work if you really want to do something that people can recognize.
Since the labs don't have to process that anymore, do they know what they're doing?
That is one of the problems, too. That's why I don't like to do black and white today, because the results are always very poor. And those who have this obstination, like Woody Allen, for instance, of doing black and white, they bump into a wall. I mean, it just, what can you do? It's such an unusual thing. Labs don't know how to handle it anymore. And also cinematographers, us, we don't know how to do it anymore. It's an art perdu, a lost art.
You know, you mentioned earlier that when you started working in movies, that you were the director and the cinematographer. You were directing the documentaries and you were shooting them too. Things have gotten very, very specialized, perhaps more so in America than in other countries.
Well, it always, no, but on the other hand, that director, cinematographer figure, it still exists. There are still many directors of documentary. I believe the documentary should be done by the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, how can a director tell a cinematographer do that and do this? You know, there are always instant reactions that it's impossible to develop. So, no, there's still many people who do documentary and who are like an homme orchestre. No?
Do you think things are too specialized? For instance, in America, you point out in your autobiography that the cinematographer can't run the camera.
Well,
this is
the legitimate Hollywood cinema unionized.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also in America, parallel to that, you know, non-union movies and movies made, thank God, you know, in the other way, in avant-garde and with little crews and little money. That film we made, Nobody Listened, was made that way. It's a non-union movie with very little money and an incredibly small crew.
You've made nine movies with you made nine movies with the late François Truffaut, and after Cuba went to France, and this was at the tail end of the French New Wave.
Or? Yes, in fact, I always have that image. Is that it's like if I got the last car of a train that was already speeding up.
How did that change you, seeing the French New Wave movies and then working with the French directors when you got there?
Well, I didn't work right away. I was, for 4 years, I was starving in Paris. I went back into teaching. It wasn't easy. And I didn't even have money to go to the movies. I skipped many of the movies of this early period because I couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle, really, that I got to work with these people. And as I say, I got the last car, you know, it's... Some people identify me with the new wave. In fact, I got into the middle of it, you know. I was lucky enough that they still got it.
But once you did start working as a cinematographer, how did what you were doing change you? I mean, what was different than what you'd... Obviously, it was feature films, it was fiction film.
What I had done before?
The technique.
Not really, nothing. In fact, what I brought into movies, if I have brought into movies, is my experience in documentary, because that's what I had done in Cuba. I did documentary with no lights, with available light. So when I did My Night and Maud and La Collectionneuse and The Wild Child, I used that technique. It's like they're like documentaries in a way.
Do you feel that many viewers think of the cinematographer too much as a technical person, part of the technical crew, as opposed to part of the artistic vision behind
the
movie?
Yes, that's one of the mistakes. I think the schools, film schools, they always have those exams to accept people, and they are always insisting in mathematics and chemistry and things like that, which really you use very little. If you are a cinematographer, unless you manufacture film and you go out to Kodak to work in laboratories, but otherwise, you don't really need that. And I think by doing that, they eliminate the people who are artistically inclined. And I think it's an art. I think it's an artistic activity. I don't know if it's an art, but it's an artistic activity, as being a cinematographer.
Your next movie is going to be with Martin Scorsese. I forget the title of.
New York Stories. It's composed of three stories, each one directed by a different director, an omnibus movie, as they say. One is directed by Woody Allen, the other one by Francis Ford Coppola, and the last one is Martin Scorsese, which is the one I'm going to do.
Have you worked with him before?
I did a little TV commercial in Italy for Giorgio Armani, and I admire him enormously. I think he's one of the greatest directors in America and in the world, so I consider myself very privileged that he called me.
Now, you choose your movies according to who's directing them. What specifically are you looking forward to about working with Scorsese?
Well, I praise style very much. You know, there are some good directors which I don't admire because they don't have a style. And Scorsese has a style. There's that nervousness, that New York electricity. And I think he has a style. He has a signature. I like to work with people who have a style, who have a universe of themselves.
Now, your style is somewhat international in that.
Oh, I don't have a style. No, I mean, I try not to have a style.
Uh-huh.
Problem is, I don't succeed, but I try not to have a style. I try to adapt myself to every movie.
And you've done that in many different countries. Is it really different working from one? Let me ask you, let me put it this way. I have friends who tell me that their lives were changed by going to Italy because the light is so beautiful. Is it true that the light is different in different countries, and does that affect your work?
Well, the light is the same everywhere, but it bounces differently against the architecture of Italy and the vegetation. That's what they mean. Of course, some countries have more clouds than others, but, I mean, sunlight is the same. No, but the look of the countries, of course, it does make a difference, but the world is shrinking, you know, and I don't find any problem about moving from one country to another. On the contrary, it stimulates me. I like this change. Like I do, I like to do a big movie and then make a little one, and make a fiction film and then make a documentary. I like the alternate.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but what do you think are the movies that cinematography should be measured against, the greatest, the best shot movies that you've seen?
Well, I think that the films which have to do with common things, that's where you can measure a cinematographer. As I said before, films with landscapes, they're the ones that pay the most, but they're not how you should measure a cinematographer. See a normal day, everyday film, and that's it.